Hello and welcome to Kind to Your Mind. I'm Ian Brannan, and in this episode, we're looking at mental health, and in particular, anxiety and sleep. Joining me to talk about it and to give you some useful tips is Dr. Paul Campbell, a consultant clinical psychologist who works across a number of mental health services and organisations in the northwest of England. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to speak with you, and I think we're in a very different place from the first episode that we did of this series around about a year ago at the time of recording, and then we were talking about a complete set of unknowns in the world. It was all very confusing for people. Lockdown was on. We didn't know what COVID meant, how it was going to affect our lives, what the way out of all this was going to be. And now we have the answers to a lot of those questions. We've discovered and discussed the effects, particularly of stress through the course of all this. But stress and anxiety tend to get mentioned often in the same breath many times. But focusing on anxiety in this episode, what is anxiety and what can its impact be on someone's mental health and well-being in particular?
Some range from very what might be called mild or less serious anxiety, such as things like phobias. So people who are afraid of certain objects or places or situations and avoid them as a result. But even something as simple as that can be quite debilitating for people. And anxiety can range from simple things like that right through to more serious conditions, like things like obsessive compulsive disorder, even post-traumatic stress disorder, where people become extremely anxious and extremely debilitated and their functioning is extremely impaired. But across all anxieties, there's one common theme that emerges when people experience any type of anxiety disorder, no matter how mild or serious. And that theme is that they overestimate the threat that they're under, and they underestimate their ability to deal with that threat. And that applies through everything, through every type of anxiety.
And are there a few obvious signs that someone is experiencing anxiety? Perhaps even someone listening to this that doesn't realise perhaps they're experiencing anxiety. What does it feel like, and what should people be looking out for?
Some of the things that would tell you that you might need a bit of help with anxiety, and that doesn't mean that you need some serious therapy, but just that anxiety might be an issue that you want to think about, is that feeling of even being nervous, on edge most of the time, or not being able to control worrying thoughts. Often people worry about things that they know they don't need to worry about, but can't switch those worries off, or they have trouble relaxing, trouble sleeping. So some of those things that they see within themselves. Also some of their behaviours that they might spot, or those around them might spot. So for example, not doing as many things as they used to do, avoiding doing certain things, and other ways that people might cope with the feeling of anxiety is things like using alcohol a bit more, or staying away from other people. And so there's some behaviours that you can spot in other people that would tell you that they might be experiencing anxiety. So those are the types of things to watch out for. And all those things obviously are very normal. It's normal to worry. It's normal to become annoyed or irritable. It's normal to have trouble relaxing. But if that lasts for, we would say if it lasts for more than 2 weeks, then it's something you really should seek help with, or talk to someone about.
And how does anxiety differ from stress? Because I mentioned before, they often get banded together as one, stress and anxiety, but they are they have got different characteristics, haven't they?
They do. And if you a good way to think about stress is not as one concept, but to think, instead of thinking about stress, of thinking about stressors that are in your life and coping mechanisms that are in your life. So there are times when you might have a lot of stressors in your life. You might be busy at work, you might be under a lot of pressure at work, there might be pressure in relationships or finances, so there might be a lot of stressors. But if they're balanced out with coping mechanisms So if you have good support, you've good colleagues you work with, or you've good access to information, or you've ways to manage the stress that those stressors cause, if those coping mechanisms balance out with the stressors, then it generally isn't a problem. And it's when the coping mechanism, your coping mechanisms drop off and you use them less. So the stereotypical example might be somebody who says, I've too much work on at the minute to go to the gym, or I've too much work on to go out with my friends. What that tells us is that the fact that they've too much work in tells us that that's exactly the right time for them to be going to the gym and hanging out with friends to manage that stressor. So that's what the way we understand stress, as it's a balance between stressors and coping mechanisms. Anxiety is a little bit different. That's when it becomes a bit more corrosive, and it usually comes as a result of longer term stress where your coping mechanisms aren't balancing out your stressors. And what happens there is people become vulnerable, and people start to develop a behavioural and a thinking pattern that causes a more long-term problem. And by long-term, I mean in lasting a few weeks or months, not necessarily something that's serious and lasts for years. So, and that longer-term problem is where they start to overestimate the threat of the stressors that they're under, and underestimate their ability to cope with that threat. So while stress can lead to anxiety, it's quite a different beast to anxiety. And obviously anxiety often has a focus. So a very common anxiety is social anxiety, people who get anxious when they're around other people. And that's usually because they overestimate the threat that they're under. They think that people might be judging them or viewing them negatively. And they underestimate their ability to cope with that threat. So that might be they underestimate their ability to have conversations with people, and that leads to what we call a social anxiety, where they then start to avoid being around other people and feel de-skilled, and that makes it feel even worse when they have to be around other people. So anxiety is kind of like a behavioural and a thinking trap that we fall into in times of prolonged stress.
Going to focus on sleep through the course of this and all of this stuff that's going on. I mean, people are anxious even without a pandemic going on, but what is the actual process and the link between anxiety and people struggling to sleep?
If you think about the way sleep is supposed to work, we're supposed to go to bed tired and at regular times. So that's the way humans have evolved. So many years ago, humans used to sleep with the sun. When the sun went down, humans rested, and when the sun came up, they woke up and went about their business, and that went on for millions of years. But part of that hardwiring is still in our system. So I suppose the best recipe for good sleep is to go to bed at the same time, go to sleep at the same time and wake up at the same time. One of the effects that all this has had on people is that it's thrown their daily routines out of the window, and people haven't been living the routine driven lives that they used to. And it's the same with anxiety. Anxiety can make us avoid doing certain things that we usually do. So if you think about that idea of just knowing what time you get up each day and knowing what time you go to bed each day, and the busy lives that we lead between times, that some of that's been taken away from us in the past year. But leaving the pandemic and COVID things aside, as you said, anxiety can lead to poor sleep, and the reasons it does that, one of the main reasons is people's thought patterns. So if you think about one of the problems that people have in sleeping is quite often they find it difficult to get off to sleep. So that's the first type of sleep problem people have. The second is they find themselves waking during the night and finding it difficult to get back to sleep. And the third is they have problems with early waking. So they wake up much earlier than they plan to and can't get back to sleep. And one of the things that fuels this is a racing mind, in that people who experience anxiety on a longer term basis, and again I'm talking weeks or maybe a matter of a month or two or longer, what they find is one of the main problems they have is switching off that racing mind.
Is there a difference between a few restless nights sleep and then ongoing sleep problems? What's the sort of threshold that people should be, you know, mindful of? I mean, because things happen, you might have things going on in your life, and obviously your brain is processing things and all that kind of stuff. But what is the point where it is a maybe more of a problem that people should be aware of?
Yeah, we'd suggest that if it lasts a couple of weeks, then there's the danger that it becomes a pattern. So as you say, a few nights poor sleep because there's something going on, or you're particularly busy or particularly not busy, and that's perfectly normal. It's perfectly normal to go through, for people to go through periods of quite a few days of a poor sleep pattern. Could be a result of anything, a bug or something physically that's just working its way through your system.
And a lack of sleep clearly affects us all. We all know how it feels if we've not slept very well for whatever reason that might be. Kids keeping you up half the night. Yeah, you've had a big night out, or whatever it might be in our everyday lives. You don't feel so sharp the next day. But a combined result of a lack of sleep clearly is not going to help people's everyday well-being, is it?
Sleep, exercise and diet are probably the three most important things for our emotional health. In fact, extreme sleep deprivation has been linked in studies to extreme mental health problems. An extreme deprivation of sleep can lead to very serious things like short-term hallucinations and delusions and things like that. But even at a lower level, a lack of good quality sleep can lead to people feeling vulnerable, irritable and more susceptible to things like anxiety and low mood. We all know that when we're feeling a bit tired and down and lethargic, that things tend to feel a bit worse than they usually are, or we interpret our world a bit more negatively than we usually do. So sleep is extremely important, and good quality sleep is important. People often say, how much sleep do I need? And there's always that thing floating around that 8 hours is good sleep for an adult. 8 hours of poor quality sleep is useless to an adult. Whereas if someone's getting a good 4 or 5 hours of great quality sleep, it's as good as 8 hours tossing and turning or 10 hours tossing and turning. So I suppose the thing to aim for is the quality of your sleep rather than the quantity of it.
And what can people do to improve the quality of their sleep?
There's lots of traps that people fall into with their sleep, and it's part of modern life. So some good rules for sleep is to start off with your bedroom and do an audit of your bedroom. Bedrooms should be places you go to sleep. That's the function of a bedroom, is to get you sleep. So the things in there should be conducive to sleep, and there should only be things in there that are conducive to sleep. So there should be a comfortable bed, there should be darkness. So if you're sleeping at a window with poor curtains and it's bright during the night, or there's street lights straight outside, you might want to think about how you can make the room dark during the night. And there should be a temperature conducive to sleep. So those three things are what you need to sleep. The unfortunate thing is lots of people's bedrooms are filled with other things. There might be a TV in there. There might be a few devices, or a phone, or a tablet. Lots of people are working from home now, so there might even be your workstation in there. And all those things are not conducive to a good sleeping environment. So the first suggestion I would give people is to do an audit of their bedroom and make sure that everything in there is in there because it's related to sleep. Obviously, there's things, if someone does have a workstation in their bedroom and doesn't have another room to put it in it, what they can do is cover it up so that they're not waking up during the night looking over at all their work stuff or their work computer or whatever might be there. Things like, I suppose the best bit of advice I could give with regards to making sure that your room is conducive to sleep is to make sure that it's free of all digital products. So there shouldn't be a TV in your room, there shouldn't be an iPad or a phone sitting beside your bed, because when you enter your bedroom, you should be going with the intention of sleeping.
So there's lots that you can do there, but what can also people do if they have someone in their house who is perhaps suffering from anxiety or poor sleep in general? And, you know, so For example, I might be fine getting to sleep, but my partner is having a disturbed sleep. What apart from the things that you just mentioned there, is there anything else that you could do to support them?
Yeah, so the second main area you'd want to look at there, so having done your audit of the bedroom and making sure it's conducive to sleep, you would then want to think about what you do on the build-up to sleep. So what your if you sleep at night, if you're in a regular sleeping pattern, what your evenings look like. And some of the things to avoid of an evening are the obvious things like coffee and energy drinks and things like that. But there's less obvious things that people often tend to do before going to bed that can prevent them from getting a good quality sleep. And there are even things like eating your main meal too late, and drinking tea. People often think, oh well, I switched to tea at 6 p.m. There's caffeine in most teas. Other things like watching television before bed, being on devices and things like that. We'd often say that you, a good hour before you go to bed, you'd want to switch off the TV and stop doing things like that. Because if you think about modern television, and I often say to people to try this experiment at home, is watch an old-fashioned movie, an old black and white western, and notice how many silences there are in it. Notice how there's not much scenery change, there's not much things grabbing your attention. And then watch a modern movie or a modern TV program or anything that's produced in the last 5-10 years, because what people who produce these things know is they need to wrestle your attention away from other things, because most people don't sit and solely watch a movie or watch television. They might watch the television and be flicking through a device or their iPad or social media or doing something else. So producers know that they need to grab your attention, and what they do that with is loud noises, making sure there's always scenery change, there's things to grab your attention. And what some studies have shown is that actually can lead to a bit of what we'd call fatigue rather than tiredness, where people become exhaustedly fatigued from watching a movie before bed. So what we'd suggest to people is watch what you drink, watch what you eat of an evening, and watch what you do in the build-up to sleep. If a loved one is having trouble with that, then do it with them. Do something else, have a conversation before bed, sit in a room with them, read a book rather than reading things like using screens. So sort of help the person to change what they're doing in their lives and the build-up to their sleep. And also one of the things that we know that is very good for people's emotional well-being is connection with others. And quite often people's evening routine, especially men, doesn't include connection with others. So there have been lots of studies showing that the way women like to relax is through communication and talking. The way men like to relax is through doing things. And quite often that connection gets lost. So connecting with others and having conversations on the build-up to bedtime is a good thing for sleep.
The whole thing about digital devices and, you know, screen time and blue light and all that kind of stuff is a big issue, isn't it? Because I know that I've got a 4-year-old now, but when she was a bit younger than that, we had terrible problems getting her to sleep. And we were watching In the Night Garden before she went to bed, and we spoke to a sleep consultant, and she said, "Iggle Piggle's got to go." And as soon as we did, you know what? That was the problem solved. But like you say, it was like an hour of wind down time, and she was fine. And clearly, she's a toddler and not an adult. But I guess the practicalities are very similar.
Yeah, and if you think about the way some children are put to bed, I'm a parent myself, and I've fallen into this trap myself, is we put them in bed and expect them to sleep. And it's the same with adults, quite often adults go to bed before they're ready for sleep in the hope that they will get to sleep. And that would be, I suppose that would be our third golden rule, is only go into your bedroom when you're going to sleep. And if you don't feel ready for sleep, don't go into your bedroom. There's nothing worse than lying in bed looking at the ceiling trying to get to sleep. Same for children, same for adults, that you want someone to go to sleep tired and ready for sleep. And that brings us on nicely to think about what you're filling your day with. And us humans need to be active, and you need to be physically active enough, and I'm not talking about going to the gym or things like that. It's just making sure you're using your body as much as you can. For some people that might be going to the gym, for some people that might be spending 30 minutes standing up. Or maybe even walking around the kitchen or making sure they're mobile in some way. We're not talking about extreme physical exercise, but just that you're using your body enough to fatigue it for sleep. And that's something that we often forget to do. Most of our evenings are spent sitting down and really using our bodies enough to get us tired for sleep might help us get that better quality sleep that we all need.
I know that you've got some tips to give us before the end of this for those who are looking for some extra advice on how they can get themselves to sleep. I just want to touch on a story that really has been around for a week or two now, but it is seems to be a big thing. And there's this phrase being used called COVID anxiety, and how this is likely to be a huge problem as we go through the post-pandemic stage. People who are fully vaccinated, they're in areas of low COVID prevalence. Everything's starting to reopen again now, and will do, you know, yet further as we go through the year. All the indications are that things are obviously massively improved on where we were. But despite all that, people are feeling uncomfortable going out anymore, and this is going to be a massive problem, isn't it, for people like yourself? Because people have been told, as you mentioned, you know, to stay in, stay away from their friends, otherwise something, you know, very bad might happen. But now, obviously, we're getting to a point where the reverse of that is going to be the message. But it must be very interesting from a psychological point of view of how humans have reconfigured so quickly to accept the rules that we've had and maybe are going to struggle to undo that reprogramming.
Yeah. So we predict that there'll be two main areas of difficulty. That we know that services like ours that provide therapies for and like ours and others that provide therapy for things like anxiety and depression, we know that referrals to those services have gone down drastically. That people, and we would expect that when people are under threat like this, they worry less about their emotional health and worry more just about their physical safety. So referrals to most services went down by about 50% from the start of lockdown right up until late last year. So that's the first problem, is people who would ordinarily have sought help with developing anxiety or low mood didn't seek it because there were, quite frankly, they thought the bigger fish to fry and that it just wasn't the right thing to do then. So those people will be feeling quite debilitated, and problems that we might have been able to help them nip in the bud after 2 or 3 weeks have gone for a year unchecked. So there's that problem, and we'd encourage people to seek out services like ourselves and CHAMPS and even when still in these lockdown phases, to seek out help. So that's the first problem we're going to have. The second problem, as you say, is people who might have been perfectly good at relating with others and perfectly socially, that didn't have any social anxiety or any problems navigating the world, that have become de-skilled or feel that they've become de-skilled over the last year. And I suppose the reassuring thing that we want to tell those people is, I suppose, at the risk of putting it lightly, if thousands of people can learn to bake sourdough during lockdown, then they can relearn how to engage with other humans. They can relearn the skills that they have.
At what point would you say then, and we've touched on a couple of examples, I suppose, but generally speaking, when it comes to anxiety and everything that people are facing, what point would you say medical intervention's needed? What's the thing that people should think, you know, enough is enough, I need to go see my GP? What are the main, say, three warning signs?
One of the problems services like ours have is people wait too long to come and see us. Because 10, 15 years ago, NHS, whatever you want, mental health services or psychological therapy services or services that help with people's mood were reserved for people who had extreme and complex problems. But what's happened over the past 10 years in both the NHS and in the charity sector is there are lots and lots of organisations now that are set up to help in the early stages, and it's more of a preventative thing so that people can seek help as soon as there's a problem rather than waiting for it to be too complex. So what we'd say is that if people are finding themselves feeling unable to switch off, unable to relax, they have that racing mind that we talked about before, or if they don't have, if they've lost interest or pleasure in doing things, or they're just feeling anxious or feeling on edge or feeling miserable or down, that if that lasts more than 2 weeks, then services like ours and lots of the services out there would be very, very keen to hear from you after 2 weeks. Don't wait any longer than 2 weeks. If these types of things are happening for a couple of weeks, then get in touch with your local services and reach out for help.
And what are some of the things people can do to help calm anxiety and get a better sleep? Are there a few little tricks and tips that you can give?
So the first one is thinking about, again, that emotional brain. That usually the thing that stops people getting to sleep is their emotional brain is engaged. And that the best way to disengage your emotional brain is things like relaxation techniques, so breathing techniques. The very simple fact of breathing out for slightly longer than you're breathing in, for a few minutes, people will notice that that has an effect on their ability to relax. So even just taking a few moments of silence and checking in on your breathing can be useful. And if you're breathing out for longer than you're breathing in, then your body starts to become a bit more relaxed. So any way they can think of to switch off that emotional brain, it could be breathing, could be relaxation exercise. There's lots and lots of relaxation exercises available online. Also things like making sure that they're physically comfortable. So for example, are they in a room that's at the right temperature? Are they able to physically relax? Things like having a bath or having a shower or doing something nice for yourself, taking some time out to do something nice to yourself can help aid that passage into sleep and switch off the emotional brain. So that's the first thing, is think about ways in which you could switch off the emotional brain. Another really good tip that we've noticed over the years is extremely effective for people is also helping them to switch off their thinking brain. So quite often people go to bed with lots and lots of thoughts whirring through their head, and that keeps them awake for a few hours or wakes them up in the middle of the night. And one thing that we found is very, very useful for people is if they keep a notebook, and whatever's on their mind as they're going to bed, just jot it in the notebook and put the notebook away in a cupboard, in a bedside table or something, and forget about it till morning. And there's something about that act of writing it down that seems to work for people and seems to help them get to sleep. None of the scientists who have studied this know why exactly it works, but it definitely works. That simple act of writing down what's going through your head and putting it away till morning seems to help people get a better sleep. So there's that. That's a good way of switching off your thinking brain.
Okay, well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thanks for the insight and also for the tips as well on how to improve our situation with anxiety and with sleep as well, particularly, and hopefully better times ahead for all of us through 2021. Dr. Paul Campbell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you to Dr. Paul Campbell there for joining us on Kind to Your Mind. Thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and I hope you found it useful. This series is in conjunction with your local councils and the NHS in Cheshire and Merseyside. For more information, visit kindtoyourmind.org, where you'll find lots of information and resources, including top tips from the Every Mind Matters campaign and ALMA, an online wellbeing portal for those living and working in Cheshire and Merseyside. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.